Welcome to Middle Grade Mavens, where two author mums discuss their favourite middle grade books, provide recommendations, and share insider industry tips for authors trying their hand at middle grade. Julie Ann Grasso is the author of the Frankie DuPont mystery series, cupcake enthusiast and part-time library book wrangler. Pamela Ukerman is a writer, dancer, and homeschooling mum who sometimes finds time for sleep. Both Julie and Pamela devour middle grade books, not only for research, but to share with their combined brood of four munchkins. Hi, Pamela, and welcome back to Middle Grade Mavens for our 96th episode.
Hello, hello.
What's been happening?
Goodness, it's Groundhog Day, I think. We're still here in lockdown town in Melbourne, and different parts of Australia are also in lockdown. I don't even know what week we're up to at the moment. I just know it's the last week of term.
Yes.
I've been playing a lot of piano and reading and doing spring planting, which is always a bit exciting, and just trying to focus on our little bubble and forget about being in lockdown. I've also been dreaming and brainstorming ideas for a manuscript that I started probably 2 years ago that I was planning on continuing with, and I might actually just start again. So that's
nice.
Kind of cool, and just kind of not writing, but just, you know, thinking about writing is nice. Tomorrow is Australian Reading Hour, so we've got that to look forward to.
Yeah.
Which is quite exciting. Given that the boys and I read a lot anyway and obviously have a heap of time at the moment, I've decided to mix up our Australian Reading Hour time, to spend the time reading jokes to each other and making ourselves laugh.
Oh, good idea.
You know, I think we kind of need that in lockdown. So,
yeah.
What about you, Julie? Do you have plans for tomorrow?
Survive the day.
Mm.
Pretty much is the only plan at the moment.
Yeah.
As you say, we read a lot anyway. But I'm sure we'll do something. We'll read 20 or 30 picture books or something.
I was also thinking about a reading party, like maybe getting some biscuits or baking a cake or something, and just like we'll just sit around on couch cushions on the floor or something and read a chapter or whatever, our own books. I don't know.
Yeah.
They've been really, really into Tintin lately, rereading and rereading Tintin and watching the movie and all that. So,
oh, wow.
Quite exciting. Yeah.
Well, I felt very smothered.
Mm-hmm.
And a few things have helped me the last few weeks, like having a little project. So Gigi and I cleaned out my open door closet. So we got a new bed a couple of years ago, and it was so big that we couldn't actually open the closet doors anymore. We had to take them off. So we've got, you know, staring into my closet. But I've always thought, oh, that would make a great little recording studio.
Oh,
and because that's pretty much how, you know, people who record at home, they do it in their closet because there's the less sound can be bouncing around. So anyway, I sort of cleaned it up and put a little table in there, excuse me, and then Gigi constructed this sort of tower for me so I could hang a doona over to close the space off and buffer the sound, and then I did a couple of voice recording samples and to upload, because I've always said I'd love to do audiobook narration. So that was lots of fun, and yes, she loved doing that with me. So what else have I done? Oh, yeah, I managed to write some words this week, which that's pretty amazing, because I think it's been about a year since I've added words to this particular book. And I've talked about in the past, I have these elaborate plot maps. So I've got a 16-page plot map. So I've pretty much got the story completely there, but I just haven't written it, which is maddening. But, you know, an entire year of lockdown will do that.
So I'm excited that you've actually written some words.
I know. And course, I'd love to be doing that every day, but I think if I could write some words a week, I'd be really happy at the moment. So,
Yeah, no, that's good.
yeah. I've also been listening to audiobooks. So I've been doing about 2 hours a day on my exercise bike just for my sanity because we've got a tiny house. And I've just discovered, and you're probably going to laugh, Georgette Heyer. Are
I have
you
no idea. No, I don't know who that is.
in? Oh my goodness. Okay. Get on and check out Georgette Heyer. So she writes Regency era, but she's like been passed from this world for like 40 years. So her probably most wildly famous book is The Grand Sophie. And I'd have to say it's one of the best female protagonists I've seen written in a really long time. So much spunk. And of course, I'm also really obsessed with how people narrate audiobooks. And this particular narrator is Claire Willey, and she was just so skilled. So I'm taking mental notes, obviously. But I think I could describe Georgette Heyer as being very clean, sort of Regency romance. And I think I got that book on our cloud library, which I'm not sure if everybody knows, but usually in your library membership, you can get audiobooks and digital books just for free. So I've pretty much been like listening to hours upon hours of audiobooks.
We just thought I
So,
could do that, and I forgot about that. I forgot you could do that.
yeah, I've also got an Audible subscription because I'm insatiable. And sometimes I've actually bought the book on Audible because I know I'm not going to get enough time to read it, even for the mavens. So there's a little confession. But anyway, let's talk books. What have you got for us today, Pamela?
Yes, I have two, and I could probably do a few more because my house is sort of like a functioning library right now with two customers. Like
Yes.
I'm constantly ordering and shelving and reshelving and weeding and yeah, the boys have been, oh, that's my was going to be my quick segue. The boys have been really into Tintin, but also we did a little video on Little Scribe of Tristan Banks a few days ago, and he was talking about Ginger Meggs, his new
Oh, yeah, yep.
based on the original Ginger Meggs, which was by his uncle.
Wow.
Joke Boy saw that and was like, oh, I really want to read that. And I was like, okay, I'll get it for you. And then we happened to be out that afternoon and driving past our local indie bookshop. And I went up and knocked
Yay.
on the door and, well, actually, I called them because there's a number. I called them. I said, I'm at the front. Can I buy Ginger Meggs? And
Oh,
yeah, they had it. So
bless it.
he absolutely loved it. So that's one book that's been really enjoyed in our house. But anyway, so the first of the two books I'm going to do today, I sort of forgot to do it. We read it aloud for homeschool not that long ago, and it was just, there's just so many books coming here and there. I just forgot. But it's Night Ride into Danger by Jackie French, which was published back on May the 5th by HarperCollins Publishers.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, so, and as you can expect from a Jackie French book, it's excellent. And that's maybe why I didn't even, because it's Jackie French, we know it's going to be good kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I wanted to review it because it's not clear from the cover or from the blurb, I think, of who it would suit. It's quite mysterious and it is a mystery. So, it has got that sort of mysterious vibe to it. But when I sort of first got it, I kind of looked at it and went, oh, like, I don't know who this book would suit or,
Yeah.
what it's about. So, yeah, we dove into it and we loved it. So the main character is young Jem Donovan. It's 1874, and Jem's father is a coach driver for the Cobb and Co. Company, ferrying mail and passengers along the Goulburn Braidwood line. Jem, whose mother is dead, has been sitting up beside his father for years, sometimes taking the reins on the easy sections of the run. But on this particular night, Jem is warned there is a mysterious passenger aboard, somebody hiding a secret. However, it turns out that each of the six passengers has a secret, and one by one throughout the journey, they're revealed. When Jem's father is injured, Jem is called upon to take the reins and steer the horse to their destination through rough bush track, fog, and other dangers. The mysteries his passengers hold are mostly minor and Jem is unaffected by them, but there's one passenger who turns out to be dangerous, a passenger who is the one character who is drawn actually from real life. And I won't say who it is because I'll spoil it.
Yeah.
So Jem must use his wits to make it through the night and get to Gorburn safely. As you can imagine, the story is absolutely intriguing and we were hooked from the beginning. And Joke Boy guessed before we'd even finished the first chapter that most of the story would unfold on this one coach journey. And he was right. But it was so tantalizing finding out each of the passengers' secrets one by one and also some secrets of Jem's family. And the setting, of course, is so evocative of the Gold Rush era, the bush rangers and lawlessness and colonialism and dangerous journeys in the night and colourful characters. And, you know, it's just that sort of style that Jackie always brings to, you know, in her stories. It's such a brilliant balance of exciting plot and life-size characters, amazing history and stunning settings. And, yeah, she really delivers even in Night Riding's Danger. My boys loved it and I did too. And I think it would suit sort of ages 10 and up, although, you know, Joke Boy's still only 8 and he was fine with it as a read aloud. So, yeah, there wasn't anything particularly scary. Some of the themes might have been sort of a little older. But, yeah, really good. Really enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah, I keep seeing it in the library and think, you know, in my excessive amounts of time at some point I will read these kinds of things.
Yeah, well, it came out at a similar time to the Ghost, not the Ghost of Howler's Beach, the second one. Of that series, which I reviewed, and she's had a few come out this year because of COVID, and I think it just kind of slipped under the radar, that one.
Yeah,
I don't think it got a lot of publicity, and I think because it's Jackie French, you can kind of assume it doesn't need to because she does them all so well. But it's different from some of her other ones, like the Hitler's Daughter series and other historical fiction. So,
yeah,
I thought I'd mention it.
Good job.
Yeah.
And what is your second book?
Yeah, so my second book is a little bit more recent and it's The Wolf's Howl by A.L. Tate, the second book in the Maven and Reeve mystery series published by Penguin Books on the 3rd of August 2021. So it's quite recent. And if you want to know more about the series, I interviewed Alison back in episode 63 for the release of the first book, which was The Firestar. This is the sequel. And it's not a direct sequel. It's two different sort of standalone stories, and it does help to read the first one first, but they're kind of separate stories, if you get what I mean.
Yeah.
So in this second book, Maven and Reeve have settled into life with the newly married Lady Cassandra and Sir Garrick. The couple have been sent on a mission by Earl Buckthorn to quietly gather supporters for an overthrow of the useless and disinterested King Bren. They find themselves at gloomy Castle Glorne, surrounded by windswept moors, where the cook has recently gone missing. The cook's absence at first is no more than of passing interest to Maven, Lady Cassandra's maid. But the lady and Sir Garrick have told her and Reeve to keep their ears open. It soon becomes clear that there is more going on than the cook's disappearance, and that somehow the cook herself is at the centre of whatever intrigue is going on. It's clear that the castle's guards are somehow involved in the scandal, and they make life difficult for Reeve. Maven and Reeve try to figure out who is on their side and who they can trust, or they may end up facing the king for treason along with their lord and lady. As you can probably guess, this is a mystery wrapped up in a quasi-historical setting and written in quasi-historical language. But I loved it. It's such a ripping read, fast-paced and full of intrigue. And the character of Maven is every girl's hero, while Reeve is suave but sensitive and kind. This is a great follow-up to The Firestar and sets the stage for at least one more book, which I'm really looking forward to.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Now, in terms of age, The Firestar centered around Lady Cassandra's marriage, which I think put the age up a little bit in terms of interest level to sort of 12 plus. The Wolf's Howl doesn't have that focus, but the language is, it's quite mature. Not in terms of sort of swearing or anything like that. It's just that sort of quasi-historical language is, it's, you know, a little bit harder to read. So I would still say sort of 11 or 12 and up, but there's probably the interest level was, you know, brought down a little bit without that marriage focus. And speaking of tweens, I just signed Manga Boy up to Alison Tate's Creative Writing Quest for Kids through the Australian Writer Centre, which is very excited about. He's been thinking about doing it for a while, and with the school holidays coming, I thought it a good time to give him a little push so he has something to do. It's a self-paced course, with I think it's 12 modules and working towards one big story. And Alison gives personal video feedback at the end of the course. So, yeah, he hasn't actually started yet. He's only, we only signed up today. So I'm looking forward to seeing how he goes.
Definitely. I'd love to do something like that for G, but she's just so very despondent with homes learning that I add anything else at this point. But
my two have kind of gotten away with not doing a whole lot lately. We do a bit, but and they, you know, they're getting all the basics, but they don't do it online, they do it with me. So I just thought it'd be nice to delegate, because, you know, I'm the maths teacher and the English teacher and the science teacher and, you know, all of that. So I just thought something different, and through the holidays, excuse me, he can do it. Oh, it's going to last, you know, more than just the holidays, but it's just something for him to do that's a bit different, and then I can delegate, and he can have ownership of that then as well, which I think is something that's a bit missing for him, is having ownership. Looking forward to seeing how he goes.
Keep us posted.
So what about you, Julie? Have you got a book for us today?
Yes, finally, I do. So today I have Treasure in the Lake by Jason Pement, published by Allen and Unwin, and it comes out tomorrow, September 14, which actually will be, I guess, the day we publish this episode. So
I might too have read this one, actually. They've both read it a few times. I don't know much about it, though, so can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so grand adventures often begin where you least expect. Iris knows this because she's read them all. But when she and her best friend Sam stumble upon an unusually dry riverbed on the outskirts of town, they make a discovery beyond anything Iris has read about, a hidden city, lost in time and shrouded in mystery. Storm clouds gather as secrets begin to surface. Can Iris and Sam uncover the truth in time to keep their friendship afloat, or will history repeat itself and pull them apart forever?
I think I know a little bit about the background of this, which I'll talk about. What was your enjoyment of this?
I really loved this for many reasons, but one in particular. And I think I've mentioned before that I do not have the graphic novel gene, so I'm often very confused as to which speech bubble I should be reading, and I get caught up in the action of the images, and then I forget what's happening in the dialogue. So go to the wrong box and read.
The words and forget to look at the pictures for more clues.
And then I have to go back and look. And maybe that's how you read a graphic novel. I don't know. But for this one, this is probably the first graphic novel I have read, and actually I didn't have to think about the sequence. It just flowed from page to page. And the images are just breathtaking, and you'll probably find yourself studying them for a great deal longer than you expected to. You're kind of just mesmerized. And the story was so intriguing, and I love the witty banter between Iris and Sam. And by the end, I was racing to the conclusion, and I just loved how the author brought the book to its end. So, and he's got some notes in the back. So Jason has written and illustrated this, and in the back, it sort of gives you a bit of, historic background on how the book came about, and
Yeah.
It was just so incredibly interesting. By the time I'd read the whole book and then read the back sort of notes, I was like, oh my goodness.
Yeah. I think my boys both read it and I said, well, how is it? And they said, oh, yeah, it's okay. And then they read it again and again and again. And then I was like, well, it must be more than okay. You've both read it like 3 or 4 times. And then Mank Boy came to me and said, Mum, I read the notes at the back of this book. And I was like, oh, yeah. And he said, it was inspired by a town which had to be flooded for a dam or something. And then it got really low and they were able to go back to the houses and see it, you know, and he was absolutely fascinated. And I think having read the notes, I think he had an even greater appreciation for it and actually enjoyed it even more.
Because one, it's odd when you know what's coming in a graphic novel after you've read it the first time, you kind of enjoy it even better.
Right. Have to read it.
And this is his, excuse me, this is his debut, and oh, just very impressive debut. So, and I think that's it for our reviews, but we are, oh, I've actually forgot to mention that I'd say it's great for 8 to 12s. And yeah, Giselle definitely read it and loved it and devoured it, which she devours any graphic novel that comes in the house. And yeah, definitely great for that age group. And Jason will stop in for an interview soon, so stay tuned, folks. Jason Pament is an author and illustrator based in Adelaide, South Australia. His debut graphic novel, Treasure in the Lake, will be released on September 14, 2021, published by Harper Alley in North America and Allen and Unwin in Australia. For the past decade or so, he's been designing award-winning animated short films, commercials, music videos, TV shows, and video games. And this, as I think I said, is his debut graphic novel. So welcome, Jason, to Middle Grade Mavens.
Oh, thanks very much. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So tell us, where did you get your start in writing and illustrating?
Right from the start, I guess I've always drawn even as a kid. I was always encouraged in my drawing, so it was something I just kept doing. And yeah, wrote in primary school and high school. Kind of wrote little stories that. That sometimes the teachers would like read out in class, and that was always big. But after high school, I studied visual arts, fine art, and got really interested in animation. And I think that's what really like got me interested in storytelling and different ways to tell stories. So there's a long-winded way of getting back to it, but I did a lot of animation and doing short films and music videos and stuff like that, and got really interested in storytelling, and then went back to try my hand at writing a book. So this was pretty much done. Treasure in the Lake was done kind of in between my normal animation work. I just decided to do it, and then it took me a long time. I think I started maybe in 2010, kind of like fiddling around with trying to write it, and yeah, just chipped away at it at a time, kind of like big stretches where I didn't get anything done, but yeah, finally got it out.
And where, I know it's got a really unique sort of backstory, but where did you get the inspiration for the Treasure in the Lake?
So there's probably a few different sources. When I was a kid, I like always loved playing in creeks and forests around town. I moved a lot, so I spent some time Ballarat and in the hills in Victoria, and I always loved that. There was a one specific event where we were visiting a family friend who had a property with a creek that ran kind of at the back of the property, and me and my brother and my sister would play in that a lot. And I remember one time we just found there were like, we're always finding heaps of stuff, just complete garbage stuff. But yeah. to us, it was like, you know, bits of sheet metal and stuff was amazing because it came from somewhere. And one time we found just like this big stash of like car hood ornaments. I don't know why someone would just dump all these car hood ornaments. I think to us as like 6 or 7 year olds, we just thought, yeah, we thought like that they're the fanciest part of the car. They must be the most expensive part.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that like sparked a lot of like we extrapolated from that a lot of stories about where it came from and like the idea that we could like walk upstream and find clues along the way. I think that was a big inspiration. And then probably the other big one was I think in 2008 or 9, I found out about the town of Old Adaminaby in New South Wales. So people that don't know, it's a town that was, I think it was constructed in maybe 1830s or something like that. And in the 1950s, they decided to flood the whole town in the construction of the hydroelectric scheme, the Snowy River scheme.
Yep.
So they moved the whole town, you know, a few kilometers uphill and flooded the town, made it a big reservoir, tried to move as much as the town as they can, that they could kind of get out up off the ground. But a lot of it remained underwater. And then I think 50 years later, there was a big drought and yeah, the water level decreased so much that the old town emerged. And I think the thought of being a kid and not having that context for why it's there, like I think if I found it, I would just think I'm finding some like an Aztec, yeah. you know, relic or something. And yeah. I think in the article that I heard, they actually contacted the old townsfolk who were just kids at the time and kind of got them to go through the town and point out where they used to play and that kind of thing. So that, yeah, that was a big inspiration, I think.
That's amazing. Yeah. I've seen, you know, them unearthing, you know, Egyptian sort of statues and things and Nile and that kind of stuff, but never a full town.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I think through the making of this book, I've found that it's very common, actually, like more common than you think. Like,
wow.
There's towns all over the world where they've just either, you know, built in the wrong place or they've decided to reroute some floodwaters or something.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, so being cool. A graphic novel, I know it's got a really twofold process, doesn't it? And it's very different from just writing a book. So can you run through your steps along the way?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'd give you the ideal way. It's definitely not the way I use for this because this was my first one. I didn't know how to make a comic.
Yes.
But generally I would now, you know, if I've got an idea for a book, I'll, you know, piece together events and characters and, you know, little thoughts that I have that could kind of accompany them and then get straight into writing an outline. And that will be as short as possible, really, maybe like a sentence or two. Try to boil down the story it's just as small as I can. And then essentially expand that out. Figure out scenes and little bits of dialogue and that sort of thing until it's usually like 2 or 3 pages.
Yep.
And that's something I can show an editor as well, that it's not just kind of like some vague thoughts in my head.
Yep.
They'll generally give me some tips along the way, but after that I actually just move straight into thumbnailing, which is essentially just drawing the pictures super small. And that's drawing the layouts of the page. So you kind of get the flow of the story. And that's usually, it's so small that like no one else can really read it, like, or even understand what's happening. They're intentionally very small, so I can't add detail. But I kind of know what's happening. And then pretty much scan it all into the computer and clean it up. So that the editor can actually understand the drawings and also add kind of like speech bubbles and dialogue, so that it's an actual book that someone can flick through. At that point, when that's kind of like in a good place, I'll just, the straightforward part is just like inking the drawings and coloring them, really.
Yeah. And do you put in the actual speech as well? When they produce, they go to production.
Yep. I'll do all that as well. I think some comic artists have some like a letterer that will do that. But I just tend to, because I think I change my mind a lot with dialogue, that I'll just keep it on my side so I can keep tweaking it.
Yeah. And did you create your own font for that?
No, that was actually something that I was suggested to from the agent in Harper Alley. This is Andrew Arnold.
Yep.
I did have to actually, there's another reason why I actually kept all the text editing on my side, which is a bit of a pain, but the text was actually a little bit too thick for, we kind of wanted it to look like the drawing lines.
Yep.
Ended up being too thick. So I had to like come up with a way to like shrink, squeeze all the text. And make it wobbly as well, so that looks a bit more like a drawn line.
Yeah,
that's kind of my animation skills coming into it to complicate things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Fantastic! So I think you have quite an exciting story about how it came to be contracted. Will you share it with us?
Oh, sure. Well, actually, I presented this book, I think in 2013, actually, as a very, very bad, rough draft, to a really small publisher in America. They actually offered me a contract for that, but it was so small that it wouldn't allow me to even work on it, kind of outside of my work. And I was thinking, well, if I'm going to hand it to someone, like why hand it to someone now? So I didn't take that, and I decided just to work on it myself for whatever it is, 6 or 7 years.
Yes.
So I had a finished book essentially at the end, and and in that time I realized that I probably needed an agent. So I was very lucky to get my agent Sarah Crow in America.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually ran an auction.
And that was sorry to interrupt, but we like the nitty gritty. And that was by sending along like, a sample of this book.
Yep. Yeah. So I sent a sample to Sarah. And then she, after that, seemed to like it and asked for the full manuscript.
Yep.
And then a bit of time later, she, kind of a bit of back and forth about some editorial points, and after that agreed to represent me,
and then an auction,
which is amazing. Like had a week where almost every day I was just talking to an editor at some American publisher, and then they all decided to bid, which is very, very grateful for. I definitely didn't expect that. Yeah, I was just hoping that it would get published at all. Because I was very unsure of whether presenting a finished book would be viewed very well.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I asked a couple of the editors and they said it could go either way. If a lot of the book they don't like, they'll feel a bit funny about asking to change it because it's all done.
Yeah.
So I think I was lucky enough that they liked it enough that the changes they asking weren't dramatic enough. Yeah. And I was also tried to say that I was very, open to feedback and stuff, even though it looked like a finished book.
Yeah. And so how did you choose in the end? Or was it gut instinct or?
It was a bit of, obviously the bid was important, just because the higher bid means I can work on the book for as much as I can. But also definitely put a lot of thought into the editors that I was meeting with. They're all like lovely, and they're all really had really thoughtful things to say about the book, but I felt like it was important to be able to communicate really easily with whoever it was. It was very fortunate to have Andrew at Harper Alley, who was really keen for the book, and he's great and has really good points, and I couldn't be happier, really.
Did you sell this book as a standalone and then with a chance for a sequel, or how did that go?
In America, it was the contract was for a 2-book deal, but because this book is, well, I see it as more of a standalone story. Maybe it could be expanded if people like the characters enough and stuff. Like, you can always figure out what they do next. But I've got some other ideas for some other graphic novels that I'd really like to do, which I'm kind of halfway through doing now.
It's a big it's a big commitment, isn't it? So you're gonna do it, you've got to really like.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. They take a long time.
Yeah.
I'm able to work on the next one full time, and it's still gonna take, you know, the better part of 2 years. Probably. Then more time for it to actually be released, because they take a long time to get released.
That's just handy, isn't it? And editing in a graphic novel is like obviously very different. So did you have like your editor looking at the text and then looking at the visual and saying, oh, that doesn't quite marry, or does this print need to be here? Is that how it works?
Yeah. There's it's a little bit of a weird one with this one, because it was so much of it was already done.
Yep.
So I think if I was starting anew, there would be a bit more involvement. But there was still, you know, suggestions to remove panels or add panels or add full pages. Or even just not exactly prescriptive ways to fix it, but to fix problems, but just spelling out, maybe this is a problem, could you think of another way to tell this part? And then there was there was a lot of involvement specifically in dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, I guess it's a lot easier to change dialogue. So if an image doesn't quite tell the story or isn't clear enough, it's easy to just add a few words just to hit home. And that's something that Harper Alley especially had, were really great at making my dialogue a lot better.
That's good.
Very happy with that.
Well, I actually say, you probably never listened to our podcast, but I say to Pamela that I really don't seem to have the graphic novel gene. Like, I don't really know where to read, because I didn't grow up reading graphic novels, whereas my 9-year-old knows how to read graphic novels and just basically plows through them and you know, totally gets it. But when I read yours, I remember thinking to myself, I haven't had to think about where to read. Like, I just followed the story, and that never happens for me. So
that's awesome. Like,
this is really well done. This is really well done. I really need to tell this guy. He's done a good job. But
my wife has the exact same comment, actually, that she has the same thing with reading graphic novels.
Yeah.
There is like an inbuilt, there's some sort of inbuilt, something we're taught, like taught or not as kids.
Yeah.
It feels like. Yeah, I think you're right. And even like if I read kind of a Marvel or DC thing, I think they've got their own kind of grammar to them. So I have the same thing sometimes. I'm not exactly sure what speech bubble they want me to read in certain sequences. So maybe I've got it too. I'm just catering for us.
maybe that helps immensely. So obviously the illustrations in Treasure in the Lake are they're cinematic and breathtaking and exciting, and they tell the story wordlessly for a majority of the book, I guess. So do you think that your animation background really helped you to hone those skills, or is it something that comes in your storytelling?
Yeah, I think for sure, coming from this, from doing animation, especially short films, it's easy to make a short film or a music video or something, obviously a music video, but a short film without dialogue, because
yeah.
Dialogue adds a lot of complexity with firstly, like finding good voice artists, recording the financial cost of that, and then lip syncing and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So there's a big emphasis of just telling the story visually. So yeah. I think that was definitely part of it. And it's probably just also my taste in film and in animation and even comics. I like wordless wordless books. There's a comic artist called John McNaught in the UK that makes beautiful wordless, not all wordless, but largely wordless of comics that are very ambient and cinematic. And he was a big influence.
Yeah.
But I think it's also, again, like going back to maybe not being a big comics person as a kid, I think I feel like with comics, the visuals are the strength of the medium. Yeah. So if I open up a comic and there's a big slab of text, even though I like reading, you know, prose novels, like I still feel a bit like I don't want to read it. I think I was thinking about this earlier, and I think it's because I want to look at the pictures.
Yeah.
But if there's all this text, I'm kind of like, my eyes are like darting back and forth between the dialogue and the picture. I just want to look at the picture.
I think that might be my problem too.
Yeah. But my goal is like weirdly to, I want it to feel like an animation almost. Like I want it to jump out of the page, like, and move with the pace of a film.
Yeah.
So I think that naturally leads to wordless panels.
Yeah.
And the idea of kind of like showing but not telling is big in film and in all medium.
If you could give yourself, your pre-published author self, a little pep talk about something, what would it be?
I think obviously as a first book, like I just went through a lot of periods where I just felt like the story was broken, like I couldn't figure it out. So like a character was doing something it didn't feel like they would do, or it just felt like the whole like the story was just constantly breaking. And I think I would tell myself that that's completely normal. I'm not, it doesn't mean that I'm terrible at doing it. It just means that I'm just going through the process of making a story. Like stories are very messy things to kind of pull together. And they just come out in one go when you sit down to write it.
Yeah. So what is next in the wings for Jason Pament?
Yeah. So as I said before, I'm doing a new graphic novel that's very different to what to Treasure in the Lake. It's kind of untitled at the moment, so I can't really say too much about it, but it's based on the coast, holiday house in a place called Australia, and we spent a lot of time there kind of playing in rock pools and tide pools and stuff. So it's kind of based loosely on that, but it's got a big fantasy kind of slant to it as well. And really looking forward to it. I think it's I've thumbnailed almost all of it, and really liking what's happening in it so far.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, what a delight it has been to chat to you, Jason, and where can we find you online?
Yeah, sure. My website is jasonpament.com, and that has some links for pre-order links and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you can also follow me on Instagram and Twitter if you wish.
Great. And it's due out, I think, in almost
Yeah, in America
12
it's
days.
yeah, I think it's September. Oh no, I should know. I keep forgetting because I've got some. I think it's September 12th or September 14th in Australia, and September 7th in America.
Oh,
I might be getting that completely wrong.
no, I think that's what I have it down as. So, well, good luck, and we can't wait to see it go into the world. I'm sure it's going to be a huge hit. So,
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thanks again for having me. This has been really good.
no worries. And when your next one is done, which we know will be 2 years away, come back on. We'll talk about
Yeah, no worries. I'll just have a big white beard and No
Yeah. Thanks again, Jason.
worries.
Thanks for stopping by Middle Grade Mavens. If you'd like to know more about the Mavens, log on to middlegradepodcast.com. Or to find Julie online, stop by julieandgrassobooks.com. And to find Pamela, stop by www.ukerman.net.